know, I can eat a peach for hours.
Do you want lunch?
You're A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
I can't talk too long. I gotta poo.
Oh, no, no, not the peach! Not the peach! Ah!
It's like looking in a mirror, only not.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of Effin' Birds Presents Travolta Cage, a podcast about the two greatest actors in movie history. I'm Clint Worthington, editor-in-chief of The Spool and senior writer for Consequence of Sound.
And my name is Nathan Raven. I am the proprietor of Nathan Raven's Happy Place and the author of the books The Weird Accordion to Al and Postal, and the co-host of the podcast that you are listening to now, Effin' Birds Travolta slash Cage.
Yes, indeed. and we are blessed with a very special guest today, Justin McElroy, co-founder of Polygon. You host the show that has made me laugh the most on YouTube, Monster Factory. Very pleased to meet you, sir.
Thank you. It's such a thrill to be here. And blessed is the right word. There was a worse guest, and then Jesus Christ, the Savior, laid hands upon them and transformed them from a bad guest into me. It was a miracle. It was a blessing. A blessing.
Yes, yes. Indeed, indeed. There are only one set of footprints, and they are your footprints. So for those of you who are just joining us, the premise of this podcast is that we are going through the filmographies of one Sir John Travolta and one Sir Nicolas Cage in chronological order, and sort of seeing where their careers diverge and meet. And oh boy, it's a weird, weird time. For those of you who are following this podcast, Cage usually wins, because I think overall the thesis we're landing on here is that Cage is like a capital A actor. Like, he, you know, he's absolutely a crazy ham, but he's got it where it counts. And Travolta tends to coast more on his charisma and his sweet dance moves, unless it's the 1989 movie Perfect, where he just kind of grinds in Kelly Preston's face. But this may be the rare occasion, maybe, well, it depends on how this conversation goes, that the Travolta film may well win out. I know, right? Nathan, what are we talking about this week?
This week we will be talking about two movies about two guys who sure know how to handle themselves in the cockpit. and I mean that both literally and as a crude sexual double entendre, of which there are a fair number. We have the incredibly forgettable 1990 Top Gun ripoff, Firebirds, for Mr. Cage, and the 1989 blockbuster, Look Who's Talking, which made almost $300 million for Mr. Travolta. And yeah, we're getting to the same point in time now. They're starting to converge in sort of weird and interesting ways, one of which is, you know, we could have talked about all these weirdly simpatico elements of it. These are both about dudes who love to fly
and have trouble maintaining their relationships. Except for, I guess, Travolta. The whole thing with Travolta's character in Look Who's Talking, he seems like he's supposed to kind of be the perfect, like, he's a little immature, but, like, he's definitely, like, what Kirstie Alley needs right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, considering how much she spends in the movie pining desperately for the good looks and sexual charisma of George Segal.
Yes.
If she thinks that dude is the sexiest dude ever, like, I'm surprised that she doesn't, like, her brain doesn't explode with sexual bliss from being around a 35-year-old.
I frankly don't know why they bothered to cast George Segal and Abe Vigoda in the same movie, because you could have just swapped them.
Apparently Edward Herrmann was up for that role, but he wanted too much money.
Wow.
Which it makes
when
sense.
Too cheap for Edward.
Yeah. It makes sense that Robin Williams wanted too much money. He was one of the many, many people they went to who would have been a million times better than Mr. Bruce Willis. But yeah, when Edward Herrmann is pricing himself out of a role, maybe you need to rethink things a little bit.
Right. So yeah, let's talk about Look Who's Talking. Yeah, I know,
nice
right?
segue there.
Nice. Giving me the appropriate gap in audio to throw in the. This is why I do this professionally for a pittance. By the way, patreon.com/revoltacage. Please pay us any money. It's very helpful right now.
Our $100 million Spotify deal fell through at the last minute.
Yeah.
They said it went to somebody else who was slightly more popular than us, so we need your money.
Yes.
Even now, more than ever, with the caveat that we don't need your money, use it for something good.
Yeah, the guy who somehow eclipsed Andy Dick is the most problematic news radio caster. Yeah, who knows?
It's the most natural thing in the world.
No.
Yes.
No.
What? How could this have happened?
I take it this wasn't a planned pregnancy.
It's a beautiful, magical experience.
St. Jerome's Hospital.
John Travolta. Oh,
come on, breathe deep, breathe deep. Try to help me just fine.
Kirstie Alley.
Give me some drugs.
Oh, thank you a really lot.
Now that is a little more like it. Hey, here's Mr. Hand here. Wow.
And Bruce Willis as the voice of Mikey.
Help! Put me back in! Put me back in!
So you're the one that's been kicking me.
The one that ate all that spicy food.
Now Mikey's mommy needs his help.
I'm gonna get you the best daddy there is.
All right, I'm on the case too.
But when you think like this little guy...
Boy, I gotta think about getting my own place.
There's a lot to distract you.
One of those little furry things over your eyes. No, let me grab one. Come here. There we go.
Discover with Mikey the wonders of life.
Fellas, listen, I got something cold and wet in my shorts down here. Guys, listen, fellas.
The unexpected delights of family.
Oh, yeah, she's gone.
And the gratifying search.
You know, that's breast milk.
For the perfect daddy.
Mikey does need a father.
I just thought of someone perfect for you.
You'll love him.
Was that clown? I want you to be my daddy. And I'll tell mommy about it.
You really think you're responsible enough to be a father?
Yeah, this is called driving.
This ain't so tough.
Mikey!
Mikey!
Well, I got this driving thing knocked.
Look who's talking.
What a sweetie.
You must be thinking the same thing I am.
Lunch. Yeah, right back at you, babe. Mm.
Justin, why don't you describe the madcap insanity that is Libby's talking for us?
Okay, so Kirstie Alley has an affair with a married man who she desperately wants to leave his wife. He is a disaster person that we don't know why she finds him appealing at all, but he is a disaster person who she has a child with. He is so clearly a disaster that it makes her affections for him kind of a character liability because he's a wreck as a human. She eventually figures out that he's a wreck as a human and then forgets and then remembers and then forgets again. But basically she cuts him or he cuts her out of their life after he finds out that she's pregnant, although ostensibly not as a reaction to that because it happens sometime afterwards. And she goes on a dad hunt trying to find the perfect dad for her beautiful baby that seems to age in bizarre Jack-like intervals that is honestly unsettling. As a father of a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, there is this jarring thing where it's like we've just skipped a year of the child's life at random. I mean, just at whenever
it felt to me like they couldn't keep track of the child actors. Is it?
Yes.
So sometimes like the 9-month-old came in, sometimes the year and a half one, they just kind of mixed a lot of things up. It really felt like somebody was completely asleep at the wheel for the whole talking baby part, which is the part that everybody loves that made it a huge hit.
And upon rewatch is the least necessary thing about this. Like, I couldn't help but think that, like, if Bruce Willis wasn't doing this talking baby shtick, this might be a lot better.
It would be so much better. And you were kind of talking about how perversely unappealing George Segal is in this role. That's partially because in real life, according to Amy Heckerling's Secret Daughter, the character was based on Harold Ramis. Yeah, who was her secret father and who Amy Heckerling had a secret baby with. And she did not discover that her father was Harold Ramis until she was 19 years old. She grew up thinking that Neil Israel, who co-wrote Bachelor Party and Police Academy, was her father. So kind of knowing that makes more sense. Like, it makes more sense that you would be hung up and obsessed with a dude who had the talent and the appeal and the mind of Harold Ramis than a dude who sells furniture and looks like a 55-year-old George Segal, who, again, was a total stud as recently as 25 years earlier, and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf has lost a little something in the ensuing decades, I would argue.
Yeah, yeah. This is a very late 80s, early 90s kind of movie in that, like, it deals a lot with, like big, fancy New York dudes in suits who are, like, starting to get in touch with their feminine side or a little bit. Or, well, like, what's that line he has? I'm going through a bit of a selfish phase right now. Where they're finding a way to intellectualize your own sort of, like, just macho bullshit.
Well, and another thing that I found striking is that she says that he's incredibly handsome more than once. You kind of had a little bit of the Lisa sexy dress rule, which I take from The Room, where if you have to state over and over and over again in dialogue that a character has a certain appeal, you've kind of lost already. You know, it should be apparent. Nobody has to say, like, hey, that John Travolta is a handsome guy with charisma, because you see it from his performance. Whereas you need to be told that there's a reason, like, and literally, like, a third of this weird movie is devoted to that subplot that, again, I think could probably be cut out entirely. Like, what exactly does, and it also, interestingly, kind of makes her more of a, like a morally ambivalent figure, because she is the other woman and she's having an affair with a married man. And that I found was kind of interesting. But my God, it just goes on and on and on. And again, so rooted in finding George Segal incredibly sexy and irresistible. And again, perfectly handsome guy, fine actor, not doing anything for me in this role.
Yeah, I'm surprised watching this movie that it took us as a culture so long to coin the term fuckboy, because I feel like he's too young for that. He's too old for that. He's a fuck man.
They also mentioned that he's good in bed, so he knows how to work that
George
dick.
Segal's mystery cock, yes.
When will the Marvel Cinematic Universe get around to having the guts to adapt Fuckman?
Fuckman and the Wasp, yeah.
We've waited long enough.
Fuckman and Fuckboy, his teen sidekick, who's always having sleazy sexual misadventures.
Yes.
That keeps him from doing heroism.
I found something about the Bruce Willis child, the character. There was an episode of a TV show, and for some reason I was thinking Cynthia Nixon, but I'm not sure that's right, because I tried to Google it up and did not find anything. But it's an episode of a medical TV show, maybe like a House or something like that, where it's like a coma patient, but you're hearing the coma patient's thoughts, and it's a very sort of claustrophobic thing, because this character has thought but no agency. And there is something profound that I found kind of disturbing about the child who we're asked to get on board with as a character with thoughts and feelings, and yet has no agency or control in the world in which they inhabit. So we are attached to a character we know has a desperate desire for John Travolta to be his father, and yet cannot communicate this information. And it's like, I found it like very unsettling.
Hell. So it's like I have no voice, and yet I must scream.
Yes, exactly. What we're saying is the Diving Bell and the Butterfly ripped this off.
Or Johnny Get Your Gun, you know, the Dalton Trumbo. And yeah, I mean, totally, from the very beginning, it's just such a weirdly off-putting conceit, so badly executed. And one of the things that I found most weirdly disturbing about this movie was the animation of baby Mikey in the womb.
Oh my god.
And the fetus, and he has like these blue Bruce Willis eyes that are so disturbing. And yeah, I thought
it was
about
cool they could get H.R. Giger in.
Yes,
I
thought about Eraserhead, and then I thought, like, this is like pro-choice propaganda, and like some abominations must be aborted before they can, you know, be unleashed onto our world. And it's just so disturbing. And again, just the over-sexualization of babies is something that I don't care for, and something that this does.
So many baby dick jokes.
Oh, and one of the first lines he has there is like, he sees that he's growing a penis, you know, on his little fetus body, and he goes, "Oh, I got a third arm. Why can't I stick it in my own mouth?"
Yeah,
and again, you're supposed to be like, that's naughty but nice and very fun. I'm like, I don't want a penis in the mouth joke for a baby.
Are you saying you don't find it appealing when Bruce Willis makes an orgasmic noise as the sperm enters the egg?
I'm pretty sure, I feel like we gained so much insight into Bruce Willis's own sex life.
Well, he's apparently fucked up on Demerol when he's born. Like, this baby knows how to fucking party.
I just, the existential nature of this whole, the idea of this baby who has, like, all of the knowledge and insight of kind of an adult, or at least the language, the cognitive abilities of an adult in the brain, it reminded me nothing so much as David Lynch's Dune.
Where
like people are like in that world, if you drink like the spice water or whatever, you're born with like out of the womb with all the facilities of an adult, and how terrifying that might be.
And again, there's just this the over-sexualization of the child. These are lines that are like very, very like trailer lines, commercial lines, mm-hmm. of John Travolta leering at a woman's breasts and saying, "Hey, you must be thinking the same thing that I'm thinking, hey." And he's like, "Yeah, lunch." And it's like, what? And it's like, no, he's not thinking that way because he's not a sexually mature adult. He's not sexually attracted to adult women because he's literally 3 months old, you friggin' pervert. And it's a measure of like how badly the gimmick doesn't work. And then I also have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. And I found myself thinking throughout the entire film, shut up, kid. I don't care for your commentary. I don't care for your wisecracks. I think you have a crappy personality. Your voice could be a lot better. And I was surprised to find out that apparently Bruce Willis did some pretty X-rated improvisation, which surprised me because it seemed like he wouldn't do an ounce more work than is absolutely necessary to get his enormous
job. I feel like Bruno is really bringing it. he is having a time of his life. I don't think any lines were written. I think watch the movie and like, yeah, I'll talk
it's
over
actually
what.
Just a commentary sure. track. Yeah, yeah.
Here's what I bet this kid's thinking right now.
No, they had to cut out all the jazz harmonica. His brain. Release the jazz harmonica cut.
But again, you talk about, and I think this is a movie where it has, it's this. That's true. Well, it's this weird combination of like kind of this 1970s movie about a single woman who has an affair with a married man and she's hung up on him and she's like obsessed with finding a father for her child, meet the hackiest, most gratuitously commercial 1980s romantic comedy ever. And there's this kind of like weird tension and this weird not really being one and not really being the other. And again, I feel like this is a movie that totally works in spite of itself. It works in spite of its central gimmick not being good at all, in fact being really bad. It works in spite of all of these like scenes and moments that just don't come together, that kind of beg for the editing room floor. Because the thing that works is Kirstie Alley and John Travolta, and the fact that they have every single song you've heard in a million movies are also in this one. It's like, how can you go wrong with John Travolta dancing with a baby to Walking on Sunshine? But it speaks to how insecure this movie is. They're like, that's not enough. That's not enough audience appeal. We need to throw in that the baby's like, hey, this guy's great. I like him a lot. I want him to bone my mom. Hey.
Yeah. I mean, this movie is scored like a yogurt commercial. And I think perhaps to its, you know, it's one of those things where you go back and you see the Rosetta Stone of where it all sort of came from. And
well,
so,
and it's so on the nose too of the scene right? where the sperm are racing into the egg. They go, "I get around." "When I grew up to be a man" is used to illustrate him growing up to be a man. It's just all
when the baby is crying a lot, they play "Cry Baby" by James Joplin. Like,
and it's so cheap and it's so effective. You know, especially with John Travolta, you know, and Tone Without Pity. One of the things about this is I find it can be hard to separate celebrity Trump supporters from their celebrity Trump support. That includes Miss Kirstie Alley. But I gotta say, she was adorable in this movie. I thought she was like funny. She was sexy. She was relatable. She had amazing chemistry with John Travolta. I felt like this is a movie that established that Kirstie Alley is a movie star. And then she never really did that ever again.
That's so interesting because I found her performance so one note. I just felt like it was constant whining about George Segal not liking her, and then whining about the baby, and then whining about not having a dad for the baby.
She's very neurotic, and she's very obsessed with appearances. And I think that's one of the things that I found kind of interesting about this is that there are a lot of elements of it that are not sympathetic. They're not terribly nice, you know. Like I think there's this, again, talking about the movie succeeding in spite of herself. She kind of has these fantasy sequences where she sort of skips ahead in time and imagines how these different guys she might want to be the father of her child or the father figure, and she. She is about to have sex with John Travolta, who, again, 35-year-old John Travolta, oozing charm, very hungry, very, you know, perfectly cast.
Very lightwash jean.
Oh, very lightwash jean. Very, very, very fetching mullet. And she fast forwards to this sort of white trash, utterly classist nightmare where he's just this poor guy and he comes in and it's like, you know, 1950s, you know, honeymoon is type
places
thing.
To eat for free.
Oh, hey. It totally is like, hey, kids, now I'm going to belch for a minute and a half for no reason. And it's supposed to be repellent, but it's kind of charming and it's kind of appealing. And it's just because of John Travolta and because he's so charismatic that the scene that is very classist and kind of mean-spirited kind of comes across as kind of sweet and kind of validating of, you know, the blue-collar, you know, experience.
I think that's part – it's part of what I think makes the movie not work for me is that – she is desperately looking for ostensibly she's desperately looking for someone to be the father of a child. There is this man, this beautiful man in her life that cares for her child deeply, and she does, and it's like the romantic comedy version of the zombie is coming out of the closet and everyone's screaming like look behind you, like it's so clearly that I think it makes her a little bit like unlikable because it's like so clearly the person that she is looking for. And then even if you want to use that scene as like, well, she doesn't want to, I mean, she doesn't want to be poor. It's right. Basically what she's saying. She ain't
messing with no broke cab driver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She doesn't seem to process that or like deal with that in some way that makes a resolution satisfied. It's not like she like reconsiders that fantasy, right? She just John Travolta tells her the baby wants them to be together, and thus it is.
He will literally always and forever be part of her child's birth story.
Right. Yeah. It's like so clearly the guy that you. I mean, I found that frustrating. But even if they wanted to use the reasoning, they're like, well, it's okay. You see, she doesn't want to be poor. they have to have something where she's like. Finds out that she's maybe okay with being poor. There's some reason why, you know, that's not the issue.
And this also has sort of, you find this in romantic comedies, where it's okay to be poor. It's okay to work a working class job as long as you have aspirations. As long as you want to do more, as long as you want, if you're working as a waiter, you gotta want your own restaurant. You know, if you're working as a cab driver, you need to be an aspiring pilot. And that's one of the things that John Travolta
the cabs of the
does.
Sky.
The cabs in the sky, exactly. And I like that.
And this is maybe my ignorance of the system, but is a flight instructor, despite not being a pilot himself? Am I understanding that correctly? Those who can't teach? Is that where we're at?
The point is that you get John Travolta to dance, you get him to fly, you get him to romance a beautiful woman. You know, you're getting the whole package here. And it speaks to what a strange place John Travolta was in this point in his career, that this is the love interest in a Kirstie Alley vehicle. You know, this is a dude who won an Academy, who didn't.
Like,
he was nominated for Academy,
star.
who's one of the biggest movie stars of the late 1970s. And a decade later, he's like a supporting player in a movie. And that's one of the things that I found interesting about it is that, you know, 5% of movies are directed by women, you know, and there are so few stories that are told from that perspective. But I felt like you had to add so much bullshit to make this palatable to a mainstream audience, one of which is just the incredibly convoluted romantic romantic comedy plotting of they meet cute when her water has broken, and then he like races all around. He says, he asks her, you know, who the father is. And when she says, oh, there isn't one, he says, are you a word that starts with the word L. And is not the only problematic phrase tossed about gingerly in this PG-rated comedy. Oh, God. And there's so many, like, weird vulgar moments. Like, Olivia Dukakis? Olympia Dukakis is really good.
Her second appearance on this podcast.
But no, she's very charming and very, and unlike Abe Vigoda, she has an actual role good lines, and it's something to do here other than be old and pretty famous. But there's like a scene of John Travolta taking a splinter out of Kirstie Alley's hand and be like, oh my God, this is so big. It's the biggest one I've ever seen. I don't know if I can get it all the way out.
What a weird scene.
And she's just like walking past her. She's like, oh my goodness, my daughter is having orgasmic sex with this handsome cab driver. And again, like, why? How does this fit into this like dumb movie about babies talking?
I just wish the scene had gone a bit longer to hear Kirstie Alley yell like, oh my God, is that wood or fiberglass? It's so sharp. Why is it so sharp? Oh, there's blood everywhere.
And it's 5-on-1 now. Oh my God.
Get the tweezers.
Oh my God, he's dead.
See, that's a funny. Writing a funny movie.
This is good.
That's
the dirty work version of that. This is a. I feel like she was kind of like reminding the world that, like, yes, I made Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Christmas Vacation, and Johnny Dangerously, and that I can use these incredibly crude, vulgar lines. But again, even there, like, you know, there's this personality to it. You know, like when Kirstie Alley is like looking at her breasts that are engorged with milk for the first time, and she's like, oh my God, I look like a Russ Meyer vixen. And I'm like, again, there's just like these weird directions that they go. But there's also, we sort of talked about the convoluted plot. So what happens is he meets cute when the water breaks, and then he ends up, you know, doing the father things because they slap a gown on him and wah, 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 wah. And then she leaves her purse in his cab, and then he returns it. And then he works out this thing where he will have his mail be delivered.
Absolutely insane. The idea that at a hospital the doctors would be like, yes, you are going to come watch this. Come on.
Right.
I'm not listening to what you're saying. You are coming to watch this birth. It's beautiful.
You work as a cab driver? I don't care about that. You're the father. That's the important thing, damn it.
Right.
Anyway, so he ends up, and at first she's like reluctant to let him get his mail at her address so that his grandfather, who has dementia, who's played by Abe Vigoda, can stay
in a nicer
place.
Which, by the way, did
they
age up Abe Vigoda? Because he looks older here than he did in Good Burger.
They did. I think they had 20 years or so, like, because he's supposed to have dementia. And again, it's one of these weird, like, sort of mostly dramatic elements that just, why is this in this movie? And there's like a scene where, like, you know, he has a bunch of candy bars, and anyway, that nonsense doesn't make any sense. So what happens? So in order to repay Kirstie Alley for letting him use her mailing address, he has to babysit her son for seemingly hours upon hours upon hours every day of the week. He's doing it. I mean, this is like, if you thought like you were screwed when you helped somebody paint for a slice of pizza, you have nothing on John Travolta here, who has like a lifetime of free babysittings in exchange for getting to use the address. There's all this weird sort of cuck element, if I could use a phrase that everybody enjoys.
I believe the word cuckolding now in 2020 element is simp.
Yeah, so basically, John Travolta really wants to have sex with Kirstie Alley because she's very beautiful and funny and charismatic here. But instead, he just watches her go on one date after another with these shitty accountants. And we have all these scenes devoted to these, like, wacky broad comedy scenes of, like, her dating dudes who
suck. Hey, remember the time that John Travolta sabotages her date?
Oh, God. Yes, yeah, so she's real liberated. She's a total woman's liberer. She loves it when you don't, you know, you don't pull out the cuff for her. And so yeah, there's, like, a 5-minute scene. And again, I'm like, this is the editing room floor. Like, why does this 90-minute long movie feel like it's 2.5 hours long? Like, why is there so much in it that just does not work and that they felt was necessary when it just isn't necessary at all?
it bumps me out that there's not one single scene of those potential suitors saying like, I'm so excited for our date. Did you realize there's a beautiful, caring man on your couch taking care of your, there's no ring on his finger and he's a beautiful, caring man that loves you and your child. Are you sure you want to go on this date?
It's crazy. Is this some kind of weird arrangement you guys have worked
out? It's crazy. You don't have a romantic relationship, but he seems to be the father already. It's almost as if the baby is trying to communicate through bad jokes and terrible one-liners. And that's
I look like every principal that's ever been on TV. So are you sure about this? Because he's beautiful and caring.
And then there's a scene where like an hour into it, or actually further, like 75 minutes into it, George Segal gets to meet his son. And I love too that the casting agent is like, oh, this kid needs to look like George Segal.
George Segal type.
This needs to be a 6-month-old version of a 55-year-old Jewish character actor. And he needs to be beautiful. And yeah, God. And, you know, again, just the personality that they gave the baby. It's a shitty personality. He's like a bad punch-up man. You know, he's just hauling out one-liners. And his relationship with John Travolta is very sweet, if the kid would just shut the fuck up. And again, it's a testament to just how little faith they had, that they felt like, you know, John Travolta plus a kid plus a bunch of Motown songs needed the further gimmick of the kid talking all the time. And then also just when it makes a dramatic switch and he's like, hey, I would like this James guy to... I'm doing the world's best Bruce Willis impersonation here. Hey, I want this...
Your Travolta voice and your Bruce Willis voice, which maybe proves the point.
Yeah, I want this John Travolta guy to be my dad. Hey, that's going to be dynamite. And then he like walks around and like gets into like the middle of the street and the climax.
Oh, yeah, we get a baby's day out climax.
Yeah.
And again, like I felt like the baby talking gimmick got worse and worse as it went along, because I felt like at a certain point he should just be able to talk now. Like, and he's moving his mouth, and
that's the weirdest. Oh, that's the worst.
It's some babe
what is
shit.
If you were the how is there not a scene of Chrissy Alley taking her kid to like a psychologist? Be like, no, I'm serious. He just moves his mouth. Like
yeah. I would have loved for this to have turned into a possession movie in the last 30 minutes, where it turns out it's not like Bruce Willis is actually just a demon that has been born into this world through a human child.
I mean, it reminded me of Baby Geniuses. Like, it had that level of artlessness, that distractingly terrible artifice, where it's like, again, and there were other kids, like, there's this, like, world of children who are all schlocky,
and that reincarnation
crappy
joke.
Open mic. Oof. Oh, my God.
Oh,
and
howdy.
And it ends with the promise of Joan Rivers as his sister in the sequel, and he goes, oh, my goodness, I'm aboard now. Can we talk? And they literally should have like ended with a wink and then like a star in the middle there, and then they fucked her over in the sequel. And you know, I mean, because we've committed to this, we will have to see the sequel. It won't have problematic Trump supporter and Scientologist Kirstie Alley and Scientologist John Travolta. We'll also have the charming dulcet sounds of Miss Roseanne Barr. Who apparently Joan Rivers couldn't do the sequel, which is weird because again we're talking
one day drinking
coffee and talking into a microphone, and I'm guessing
like Roseanne at least was like, busy with a TV show.
Well, and I assumed, and again, like when I was when I was 13 years old, I was obsessed with show business and like the business of show business. And if I remember correctly, Bruce Willis literally made about $25 million. From this.
What are you dreading more? Look Who's Talking To or Look Who's Talking
I've,
Now?
Look Who's Talking Now is an abomination. It is fascinatingly... it ends with a Jordy vehicle. It ends with a music video by Jordy, the baby rapper from France, that has like this mind-melding postmodern element where the whole cast of Look Who's Talking Now is in it.
Oh, no.
There's like a fantasy sequence, Shaquille O'Neal. They've completely lost interest in the gimmick. So it's all about this businesswoman wanting to fuck John Travolta. It's a bizarre motion picture that I'm excited about revisiting for the third or fourth time.
No, I want to see Look Who's Talking sequels into adulthood for Mikey, but he still has Bruce Willis's head, like voice in his head.
But you know what? I think they actually did the Return of Bruno as a child cartoon after this.
Perfect.
Because they were like, kids fucking love this shit. But yeah, apparently the people who passed on this, shockingly, Bill Murray, Chevy Chase, Dan Aykroyd, and John Candy. Oh, and Robin Williams, who wanted too much money.
Right.
All of whom would have been so much better than Bruce Willis, because again, it's just generic. I feel like generic smartass, generic Weisenheimer, generic bro. You know, oh god, yeah. Speaking of lines that are probably killed in the focus groups, is he goes, "Oh yeah, you know what it's like." Again, looking at the woman's enormous breasts, and he says, "You spend 9 months trying to get out, and the rest of your life trying to get back in." Ugh. Oh, and the baby's like, "Yeah, I know what you're talking about." And it's like, "Come on, dude, please stop doing your sexy bro talk." They should not have the message of bros over hoes. A little bit confused.
It's frustrating as a parent who doesn't get to see a lot of movies that deal with parenting in a way that I sort of understand it. The experience. Yeah. Like, if they had just cut out the kid stuff, I think there's an interesting movie in the idea of, like,
completely
an accomplished woman looking for... trying to figure out for herself what makes a father worthwhile, which is cool, I think, or about this movie, which doesn't really ever deal with Kirstie Alley's fitness as a mother. It makes no judgments on her, and I think this is part of the power of having like a woman writing and directing the film, is like it doesn't make any judgments about Kirstie Alley as like a mom. We assume that she is doing a great job, and that is never questioned by the movie.
Yeah, like it's realistic about how hard it is.
Yeah, right. But it's never an issue of like, should she be giving up her career to focus more? You know, that question is never asked, which I think is cool. And it's really more about like, what does she value in a dad? I think there's a really good movie in there somewhere that would have worked so much better than like, and it almost looks like they shot that movie and then just realized they had some really long shots of the kid in abject silence.
Well,
that they needed to do something about.
It reminded me a little bit of the motion picture Kangaroo Jack, which apparently, you know, was supposed to be like PG-13 R-rated, you know, kind of like adult, you know, wacky comedy with Anthony Anderson and Jerry O'Connell, America's favorite twosome. And then they focus group tested it, and they just loved the fucking fantasy sequence with the kangaroos, where the kangaroos talk so much that they're like, okay, that's the fucking movie now. We're not going to actually have talking kangaroos, but we're going to make it seem, but we're going to go for the talking kangaroo crowd. And again, it speaks to Sir Desmond, like how little invested.
A budding subculture.
Oh, because yeah, so and the second one, apparently, they advertised Richard Pryor as the, so it would be Richard Pryor and Joan Rivers. And then they somehow ended up with Roseanne Barr and Damon Wayans.
Oh, I thought you meant the second Kangaroo Jack. And I was like, Kangaroo Jack?
There is a direct-to-video animated Kangaroo Jack that I think...
I'm so sad that you know that.
Actually involves the rapping kangaroos.
I'm so sad for you.
So yeah, but again, that's one of the things that... one of the problems with the Look Who's Talking trilogy is that there's not enough for one good movie, let alone for 4.5 hours that beat this very threadbare premise into the ground. And again, by the third one, you sort of the core of like Kirstie Alley is a relatable single woman dealing with a complicated and difficult situation that a lot of women do. Like that has been lost completely. You know, this is like this bizarre upper class fantasy where everybody is sexy, everybody has money, all the animals are talking for some reason. And it's funny too, like I've been seeing intermittently John Travolta and Kirstie Alley saying they would love to do a reboot, or they would love to be the grandparents. And I'm like, again, it's a shitty idea. Like the only reason it was good is because Amy Heckerling is a good writer director.
It could have only happened in 1989.
Exactly, because like, Lord, America ain't rushing out to go see Kirstie Alley making a movie these days.
It's what we deserve.
You know?
It's what
we deserve. And she had her day in the sun. She was really good in Cheers. I think she's really good here. She was good in that Star Trek movie that she did. But yeah, I think people look at her now just like this crazy woman who thinks that Donald Trump is the savior and thinks L. Ron Hubbard is right up there with Donald Trump. So. So what we're saying is we're not entirely in favor, or nor do we think a Look Who's Talking reboot is entirely necessary. Oh, there was a TV show of this as well.
Called George Clooney.
Yeah, right? Yeah, with George Clooney as a John Travolta role, which actually makes makes a lot of sense. But yeah, Clueless.
When you can't get John Travolta, you get George Clooney.
Of Amy Heckerling's successes they tried to turn into TV shows.
Do we know if they were both involved in Scientology like before this or like?
Or is this the thing?
Yeah, I think.
Is this where they were like, listen, we got a lot of time during setups while they're filming this
baby. Let's read Dianette.
They're sticking peanut butter in this kid's mouth. we got some spare time. Let me tell you about Xenu.
I think they were both, because I believe Kirstie Alley credits Scientology with helping her get off cocaine. Uh-huh. Well, get off cocaine and start making movies like Madhouse.
Right. Well, speaking of cocaine, we should move on to our second film. But before we leave this, one final note on Look Who's Talking. The unmitigated hubris to throw Stan alive
in this motion picture.
Unbelievable. Well, and also for the context of it to be. Well, also for the context to be, this baby loves the ladies. And he goes swaggering out there like, ooh, you're so sexy.
Sexual.
9-month old baby. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm totally like Bruce Willis. I'm totally sexy and whatnot.
If they had done a fourth Look Who's Talking, that would have been the subtitle. He's talking for sexual babies.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on to the Cage half of this. Of this discussion, shall we? Sure. So from a $7 million romantic comedy that made $300 million and launched a franchise, to a ripoff of Top Gun that no one remembers, and I had to pay good goddamn money to rent in HD, Firebirds.
Now you have a new objective in your lives, to become masters of air-to-air combat tactics.
Okay, baby, let's do it.
That pilot's good.
You have a problem with women in the Army, Preston?
Not with all of them, sir.
Aren't you forgetting something?
You keep them.
Come on, show me what you got.
Gee, is this a quiz, sir?
Your whole life's a quiz, young man.
I'll wash you out if you can't cut it.
You clear on that?
I got it!
It's like sex.
I need you to help me out.
Hardly anybody gets it perfect the first time.
We're pushing these guys a little too hard, sir.
Who wants me out of here?
I think it could be one of the best. Time to rock and roll. Just so you know, I will be kicking your rear today. Good. People, there's a hostile situation. We are on red alert. This is not a drill.
You think it's fine for me to be a pilot as long as there's nothing at stake?
People are gonna die down there.
We will confront the forces of evil and kill them deader than hell.
Nathan, regale me with the tale of Firebirds.
Well, I believe that our segment should start off like the motion picture with a quote from President George H.W. Yes. Bush.
All great films.
It says, our message to the drug cartels is that the rules have changed. We will help any government that wants our help. When requested, we will, for the first time, make available the appropriate resources of America's armed forces.
Yeah, that didn't age well, did it? So, for all of Look Who's Talking's flaws, at least it's not openly fascist. Yeah. Like Firebird.
It's not an 85-minute celebration of the military-industrial complex. Could have been brought to you by Lockheed Martin. They're literally, like, they thanked a bunch of military
Lockheed Martin
contractor.
Scorsese directed this.
Oh, good lord.
Firebirds, it was conceived by some like military officers.
Well, you know that dude with the mustache who looks like he's totally a military advisor and fought in Vietnam. He's a military advisor and he fought in Vietnam. So you have this motion picture, and Nicolas Cage is in it for the first time. And this is kind of fascinating for me. This is sort of his first movie, as a generic action hero. Yeah. And he really, but it's only his second movie as a wannabe Tom Cruise figure. We talked about Boy in Blue a while ago and how that was basically a Tom Cruise sports movie without Tom Cruise. This basically is Top Gun with Nicolas Cage in the lead role and helicopters instead of
and transparently so.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's
just
naked.
Top Gun.
I mean, there's even a character, I think Peter Onorati's character, his last name is Rice. And they actually refer to him as Rice Man. And I'm like, when you're ripping off a movie and one of its main characters is named Iceman? Yeah, I mean, they might as well have called him, like, Ramus, you know? Like, they kind of felt like this is so close to being Hot Shots. This is so close to being, like, Team America World Police. Like, I actually kind of enjoyed...
Here's my co-pilot, Moose.
I enjoyed how... and again, I felt like Nicolas Cage as this incredibly, you know, straight arrow, right wing, just a guy who literally pumps himself up by saying, I'm the greatest. I'm the greatest. Yeah, I'm the greatest. Oh, yeah. I'm the greatest ever. Again, it's so over the top. It's so goony. It's so jingoistic that it enters into the realm of self-parody. And yeah. I found that.
Well, it's an 85-minute really long commercial for the Apache helicopter. Like, that feels like it is. That is the purpose of it. And they built a story around it.
You expect every 20 minutes for there to be like, and we'll be back with more after this. And it's just a scene telling you how to order an Apache helicopter.
It was for Apache
helicopters. 10 easy payments.
For Apache helicopters what Mac and Me was for McDonald's, you know? And again, there's this element, you know, where he's like, the first time he goes up there with Tommy Lee Jones, who is his tough but fair and loving and supportive mentor. And Tommy Lee Jones is a lot of fun in this movie. And Tommy Lee Jones seems to be enjoying himself, which you don't see in a lot of things there. Nicolas Cage.
This is buffoonery he can sing.
This is buffoonery he can sing. So Nicolas Cage. Nicolas Cage plays a character and he's the best and he knows he's the best, but he has trauma in his past because there was a dude and he totally blew up. So he's like, whoa. And then Tommy Lee Jones comes over and he's like, I see you. You're the best, but you can be even better. And Nicolas Cage's like, whoa, that's great. I am the best, but my goals and aspiration are to be even better. But he has to overcome this vision problem. Yeah. And also, this is a movie, again, this is a movie where they spend
he has
a lot
an
of,
eye dominance problem. He is an eye sub.
Exactly, exactly. And this is a movie where they have all the fucking Apache helicopters in the world. I mean, literally, Nicolas Cage comes close to just fucking an Apache helicopter, just like sticking his dick in its exhaust pipe. Like, it comes very close to doing that.
I want to point out the conflict here, because like the conflict is set among the, again.
Oh,
the
I know. I thought I was going to say. So he spends a lot of time in a simulator. You have access to all of the U.S. military's helicopters. You show a lot of time him playing a video game. We know that's a video game. You only have 85 minutes, and 7 minutes is like, whoa, I'm doing really good in the simulator.
Like, I think they had that specific simulator at the Museum of Science and Industry, and I think I remember playing it.
It was like some bullshit virtual reality crap. So, like, you have one big asset, and thus you have, like, all these cool-looking helicopters. But I think we should talk about how weird it is at this particular cultural moment in time that this is basically an unironic, unambiguous endorsement of the idea of the militarization of law enforcement.
Yes.
And the idea that the DEA, you know, they're handcuffed that they can't, you know, use Apache airships, that they can't use fucking fighter jets to fight the cartels. And they think that's just, gosh, that's just wrong. That is just terrible, terrible, terrible. And there's this terrorist named Stoller. And I like this too. That basically,
he's like a mercenary pilot. Whatever.
And basically, like, he's responsible for all the drugs in South America.
Which is so wild that, like, they want to take down, like, the Colombian drug cartels or whatever, but the villain is white.
And European, I believe.
And European, yeah. Like, it's a very, like, Red Baron kind of scenario.
And
right?
I remember, like, there are, like, no people of color in it. You don't actually show the cartels.
You don't see the cartels.
They sort of talk about them. They're like, oh, the cartels are all going to be there.
There's barely any people in it. You get to the end of the movie and the credits for the actor, there's six people.
Yeah.
It's like, there's only six people in this movie. It's just these six. And you realize, like, oh my God, there wasn't anybody in this movie.
Right.
And then the big threatening, terrible, tough bad guy is Burt Rhine, who, God bless him, looks like a beloved pizza chef in your neighborhood. Like, he's the least threatening man I've ever seen in my entire life. They put him in a tiny where the guy actually has to say, like, don't be fooled by its size. It's actually a very bad helicopter. And as I'm watching, I'm like, you made a movie. Why didn't you fucking get a bigger one? Just pick a bigger core helicopter.
Well, yeah, they do completely say, like, it's very small. It doesn't look like much. It's very unimpressive. But, oh, God, it's so deadly. It's so unbelievably deadly.
That feels like a metaphor.
Oh, and we have...
yeah, like, give the hero one of those. Oh. If they're the good ones, like, it's so bad. It's so strange. And the guy doesn't even really... talk? Does the Eric Stoller say anything?
I don't think he does.
No. Again, it's just established that he's the coolest, baddest, most deadly terrorist in the history of terrorism, and you should be really, really impressed by him. But we haven't talked about the greatest element of this wonderful motion picture, which is the unbelievable sexual chemistry of Nicolas Cage in any career best performance, Sean Young. Very convincing and unforgettable playing a robot in the motion picture Blade Runner, and incredibly robotic in much of what she did after that, especially here. Do you guys want to talk about the lovely, lovely scene where Nicolas Cage engages in a little high altitude sexual harassment? Oh, God.
For 35 years.
It's goddamn excruciating. Like, I see what they're doing. This is like Top Gun, if Kelly McGillis got to be in the plane with him, right?
Yeah. But like, getting a boner sort of already.
And there's sort of this like 90s faugressive sort of like women can perform extrajudicial murders too. And, you know, there's the whole sort of GI
Jane. She's also the only woman in this entire world? And he's like, I think you should be barefoot and pregnant, and I should be up flying the great air troopers.
Because I don't think the world exists outside of this Air Force base, basically, right?
The world doesn't get outside of Nicolas Cage's ego.
Yeah, and like Tommy Lee Jones's wife, who is there too. That's like, is like the sort of, you know, the very supportive sort of like army wife kind of thing. But yeah, other than that, like,
it's... Oh, God. Oh, so yeah, there's a scene dull. Where they're up there and he's like, oh, I'm on your tail and the view of your tail is absolutely spectacular. And she's like, oh, I love it when you sexually harass me. It's like, I'm going to go under now.
Everybody's kind of like, listen.
Oh, totally. You have to imagine. And she's like, she's like, I remember how much you always liked it when I was on top. Oh, totally. Right. You like it when I'm on top in the air and when we're having sex in bed. And she's like, you've got your brain in your cockpit. A line that is used twice in this motion picture. You've got your brain in your
cockpit. There's only so many. There's only so many flight dick puns.
And then boom, two scenes later, they're having the most grindingly arbitrary sex scene in the entire world. And it's just like that lazy thing of just like silhouette, sweetie, bed. Afterwards, like, whoa, that was awesome sex we had. We have so much chemistry.
That very sort of Casio-heavy score.
We both totally believe in this motion picture. We're very invested.
I know that Nicolas Cage is a very good actor. I've enjoyed him in many films. His performance in this movie is absolutely unhinged. It is bizarre that he ever got to make another action movie. After that, here's what you can feel. What you can feel is like in every scene, nearly every scene, just out of nowhere, there'll be one to two lines where he's like, I've got to make an acting choice. And it sticks out like a fucking sore thumb. Like, I'm making a choice. Like, I'm making an acting choice. Yeah. He'll yell lines at random. He'll speak lines in Cockney, unprovoked. Like, just no rhyme or reason to any of it. He just decided, like, I had better make a choice in this scene because none of these words are literally anything.
Well, and I love that this is such an incredibly stupid, such a ragingly unambitious movie that has two legitimate geniuses in it, as two people who would win Academy Awards within the next 5 years. And Tommy Lee Jones is so much fun here. He has so many incredibly dorky dad lines, one of which is, I hope you guys like history, because today we're going to be making it.
It's a full tilt boogie for freedom and justice at one point.
That rules. Yeah, I think he made up all the good parts.
Well, I also love that his character is 40 years old and then he has a birthday party. And I'm thinking, I'm older than a character that Tommy Lee Jones plays. That feels weird.
It's so strange.
Just because it kind of feels like
he's 55 since he came out of the womb. His Lucas talking story is very interesting.
Well, and this was 30 years ago. And if you look back at like Nicolas Cage's career up to this point, nothing he's done would suggest that he would make a crazy Top Gun knockoff for a division of Disney. Like, this was a Touchstone movie. It feels like a Touchstone movie. Another thing that I found absolutely fascinating is, you know, all those great iconic hit songs in Top Gun? You don't need them when you have two Phil Collins ballads.
Oh, my God.
Which is literally the only music in this, like, rah, 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 jingoistic action movie are two morbid, slow Phil Collins ballads where he goes, like, crazy on the electric drums.
And you know which one they didn't use? In the Air Tonight. It's right there.
I know. If it was Look Who's Talking, they certainly would have gone. But again, it's weird. I think you're talking about, like, I feel like Nicolas Cage sinks to the level of his material, you know, or he adjusts himself to the material. And that's part of what this is, kind of the introduction of me as a forgettable action movie star, is I will throw myself into that shit. But I won't, I won't elevate it necessarily. I just will be engaging with it on a deep level that makes it more interesting and more engaging, more entertaining, but also won't hide the trashiness of it. If anything, it just kind of, like, ratchets up the trashiness.
I think it is an interesting parallel, these two movies, between less Travolta and Cage and more Travolta and Tommy Lee Jones, because neither of them have great stuff they're working with, but they're just so fucking charismatic that they are basically carrying it. They put the movie onto their shoulders and think, you know, I can get this a little bit of the way there. Let me help. Let me do my part. And Tommy Lee Jones, I think, is the only reason. I mean, watchable seems weird. You just want it to be in a better movie. But I think when Cage is in the pocket, like, John Travolta doesn't have to be in the pocket for you to be like, oh, man, what a good guy. I'd love to hang out with that guy. He seems like a real sweetheart. Yeah. When Cage isn't in the pocket, it's like he's an alien that is just being spliced. It's like a Nicolas Cage hologram that has been spliced in with random lines.
Because he's not acting against anyone else. Like, he is giving his own performance in his own movie.
It also kind of, kind of reminded me a little bit of Starship Troopers as well. Like, an unironic, unambiguous version of that. If we were actually, you know, pro-fascism and pro the use of force. And pro the idea that just guns are awesome and weapons are awesome. And God, you talk about sort of Sean Young being terrible, terrible, terrible in this role. They're kind of like, well, okay, she's at least a fighter. She's at least a colleague. Yeah. She literally has a line in the third act. Save me, please save my ass. And then Nicolas
she like has like, to get the permission from like Tommy Lee Jones to shoot down the bad guys.
And she's like, oh, I'm going to wipe you off the face of the earth, you ugly motherfucker.
Snort on that, sucker.
That's one of the weirdest moments about their like quote unquote relationship, is when he gets the assignment to go kill the bad silent drug dealer, terrorist, mercenary, all the other, you know, bad words we can think of. He gets the assignment. Sean Young is like also going to be in the mission, and he is furious. And he comes to her and he's like, I just wanted you to be safe. Why is that so hard to understand? It's like, you know what? You know what she does for a living. I mean,
to be fair, she does say that. She's like, you knew what this was. Like,
yeah,
I
knew I was.
What are you doing? Flying around in helicopters. I've never heard of this before.
Like, I'm a colleague.
When did this happen? I didn't even know you had to drive a car. This is crazy. Painful.
In this same like thread, there's a scene in the nightclub or whatever that they're at, where he's like, I just want women to stay home and cook and clean. I don't see what's so wrong about that. Right. It was good enough for my mom. It should be good enough for you. And Sean Young's like, well, your mom didn't fly helicopters. And then Nicolas Cage is like, you're right. My mom did not fly helicopters. It's like the end of the conversation. It's just such a wild, like, I think he says something like, now what else you got? It's like, wait, no, hold on, back up.
Well, and again, he tries to win her over by starting a fight in this nightclub over her honor. And you're supposed to be like, wow, that's cool and appealing. I love the way that dude is sexist. He sexually harasses her, and he has an incredibly condescending conception of what romance and marriage entails. And he's the good guy, and we're supposed to be rooting for him because he works for the DEA. And the drug war is always good, and making it even more of a war can only be an excellent idea.
Yeah. Also, it must be pointed out, one of the many ways this fails in comparison to Top Gun is that it is not nearly gay enough. It is painfully heterosexual. Like, there is no volleyball scene equivalent.
Well, they have all the crew double entendres belong to Sean Young and Nicolas Cage's relationship. But it is interesting that she has a short haircut. She's kind of coded as being somewhat masculine, mm-hmm. Sort of the way that Kelly McGillis was. But my God, I'm sort of watching this and thinking, like, why would this appeal to Nicolas Cage, who is literally coming off Wild at Heart, Raising Arizona, Vampire's Kiss, Peggy Sue Got Married, like this incredible run of masterpieces and great films and films that people are talking about, we'll talk about for the end of time. And then you're making this mediocre, modestly budgeted, raw, right-wing fascist action movie. You kind of wonder, like, what the hell was he doing this for? And then it's weird too that this would be, in the decades ahead, this would be the rule rather than the exception. Like, he would make if you hear he's making a new movie, you're guessing it's probably a forgettable action movie. Hopefully not now, but for a solid decade, it seemed like most of what he made were four or five forgettable action movies a year.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, it's never a great time to watch a movie about, like, the over-militarization of law enforcement. But this week in particular, it felt really weird watching Firebirds.
And I would imagine that Nicolas Cage's personal politics had nothing to do with his choice to make this movie, and that his personal politics are far to the left of this ragingly, ragingly conservative, wildly hawkish movie that, again, thinks that George H.W. Bush was a cool dude, but probably not enough of that. Although it's weird when you think about it, he is the only Republican president for, you know, 30 years who actually fought. You know, who was actually a warrior, who actually flew one of these birds, you know, as opposed to being a chicken hawk and talking a big game and then, you know, bones, birds, and whatnot.
It's just so weird for a movie to, like, begin to, like, kick itself off with a quote from a contemporary president for, like, something that happened that he probably said, like, months before the movie came out.
And be like, ooh, isn't it cool that now the military is going to, like,
get usually those kinds of quotes are, like, steeped in history and portent.
Totally. I mean, if Ronald Reagan, you know, if you're going to be a fucking conservative.
Instead, it's, here's this mistake we're doing right now.
And what also just that, here's this idea they made, and here's the awesome execution. And how they killed the world's worst terrorist drug dealer bad guy.
Yeah.
You don't even see drugs in the movie.
There are no drugs.
There's no drugs. There's nobody doing drugs. There's no sense of, like, why this is important that they're doing it. It's just and Tommy Lee Jones and Nicolas Cage share a moment of character growth when they're like, I bet you're in the military for the same reason I am, to beat ass. It's like, whoa, oh God, we're not even pretending. Okay, fun. All right, cool.
Yeah, I mean, I guess inadvertently it becomes a very interesting commentary on the war on drugs, and that, like, you didn't literally even need to see that the war on drugs was, that the drug trafficking was happening to sort of ramp up and start blowing shit up in other countries.
There is a pathological lack of self-awareness in this movie. It may be the least. There is not a single moment of self-awareness in this film. I may be the least self-aware movie I've ever
seen.
It's
a film of misplaced confidence.
Well, there's no ambiguity. There's no ambivalence. There's a moral complexity. You know, none of your groovy little in betweens. It's just a matter of bad drug guys are bad guys. America is great. America is great. USA, yeah. USA, USA. Woohoo! They got them. End credits. One of the many things that I enjoyed about this ridiculous motion picture is that it's 80 minutes long.
Oh yeah, that goes down smooth.
Oh, and it goes really quickly because it has so much bullshit to get through. That it's like you're watching it in fast forward. You know, and I appreciate that, like, you cut out the 20 minutes of bullshit by, you know, editing everything down to the bone. So these scenes are all really stupid, but they move very quickly. And it goes right through you. It's a very, very breezy, very watchable 80 minute long fascist monstrosity.
Nothing. Yeah. It's refreshing when a bad movie wants to get itself over with quickly.
I understand. None of us want to be here. Let's just jump on.
Right. We're just so out of obligation. All right. Well, I think we're wrapping up a little bit here. So let's close out with Cage Match, where, Justin, if you don't know, we decide to just pick sort of random, like, not randomly, but, you know, pick which of these two movies is better, and it'll move on to whatever strange second bracket system we end up coming up with in, like, years whenever we finally get through these things. So between Look Who's Talking and Firebirds, which is better?
I mean, it's got... Firebirds is one of the worst movies I've ever seen in my entire life. I mean, I have my problems with Look Who's Talking. It hasn't aged particularly well, yeah. But it's...
It lacks the moral rot of Firebirds.
It has human beings in it talking in a way that I understand human beings to talk. I mean, it is not fascist propaganda, which is a huge compliment.
Yeah. Put that on the box.
Probably never been laid at the feet of Who's Talking. Not in a lot of the reviews. Not fascist propaganda, says Roger Ebert.
Yes. Hitler wouldn't be a fan. Raves Rex Reed.
Neither would
a helicopter to be a fan.
Yeah.
I am going to also say Look Who's Talking. Although, again, I think it speaks to the fact that this is one of the big winners in John Travolta's filmography. That it's much weaker than Nicolas Cage. You know, when he makes a really memorable movie that's a big hit for him, it's something like Vampire's Kiss or, you know, even, I don't know, The Rock. Whereas with Travolta, it's this movie that has a lot of charming aspects where he's really fun, where he's really good in it, but there's a lot that just does not work and just drags the movie down to the point where it's like, it's pretty good. You know, I would recommend it on the whole, but there's a lot in it that's just dodgy and deadly and begs for the editing room, yet somehow made it into the movie all the same.
Right, yeah. These are two movies of tremendously dated character, and yet for all the sort of dated gender politics of Look Who's Talking, that pales in comparison to the openly fascist propaganda of Firebirds. And again, like, there is sort of this between Heckerling's direction and Travolta and Christy Alley, like, being, you know, relatively charming, there's just a lot more to enjoy in Look Who's Talking than just the slog that wants to get itself over with of Firebirds. So congratulations, Look Who's Talking. Yay. Travolta, you finally got a win for a good first time in a good long time. Congratulations to you. It wasn't so much that you succeeded, but that Cage failed so much. But you know what? Take the W anyway. Anyway, I think that pretty much wraps it up for this episode of Travolta Cage. Justin, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure to be here. What a thrill.
Yes. You're wonderful. This is fantastic.
Yes. Is there anything you want to plug?
If you go to McElroy.family, McElroy, you can see all of our podcasts there. So,
excellent. So
check them out.
Thanks for listening to Travolta Cage. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your podcast platform may be. Please rate and review us. It helps us out a lot. You can follow us on Twitter at Travolta Cage. It's just at Travolta Cage. I forgot for a second. You can send us questions at TravoltaCagePod@gmail.com. Please pledge to our Patreon at patreon.com/TravoltaCage. It really, really helps us out a lot. Times is hard. Stay safe, stay healthy. We'll see you next time. Oh, excuse me. I need to go poo. I almost forgot our closing catchphrase. Because the world's on fire.